This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 12th of February 2010. Today I'm honored to be joined on the line by J. Michael Springman, Esquire. Mr. Springman is currently a Washington area attorney, but prior to that he spent 20 years in the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service. Mr. Springman, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I'm honored to have you ask me to comment on your questions.
Well, J. Michael Springman, you obviously had a long and distinguished career in the Foreign Service, but of course a lot of attention has been focused on your extremely interesting experience as head of the visa section in the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And I'm sure my longtime listeners are quite familiar with the story of your experience there, but just to make sure everyone is on the same page, Why don't you give us the details of what occurred while you were serving in that post?
Okay, well, I had been assigned to Jeddah as chief of the non-immigrant visa section and went out there in 1987. And before I went, I heard rumors that there were some strange issues going on in the visa section. The American ambassador at the time, Walter Cutler, spent 45 minutes with me in what I thought was going to be a courtesy call and talked about all the problems my predecessor had created for the embassy by denying visas to people. And nobody knew what was going on, and I asked the desk officer, the man who was sort of the embassy's ambassador in Washington to its own government, what this was all about. And he just said, well, Walter Cutler is a queer duck. Well, when I got there, I was praised as being entirely different from my predecessor and was told about all the problems she created for them there, but they never really clarified what it was. And after a while, I found out people would come to me for a visa, and they had no ties to Saudi Arabia or their own country that were strong enough to compel them to return once they'd gone to the United States. They didn't have family there. They didn't have a good job. They didn't have property and so forth. And most of the time, they couldn't tell me where they were going in the United States and what they were going to do. In one instance, there were two Pakistanis who said they were going to a trade show with the Commerce Department. And when I asked them, well, what was the name of the show, they couldn't name the show, and they couldn't name the city in which it was being held. And I had been at the Commerce Department prior to that and knew well that the American Automotive Parts Association held its yearly exhibition in Chicago. And no, you're not getting a visa. And not long after, Paul Arvid Tveit, who at TVEIT had been a clandestine service officer with the CIA concealed in the commercial section, he demanded that I give visas to these guys because it was important. I said, well, they can't tell me why they're going to the States. They can't tell me where they're going. They don't even know the name of the auto parts show they're going to, so why should I give them a visa? The law is pretty clear on this. And then he went to the chief of the visa section, Justice Stevens, who I sort of wonder about who he really worked for, and got visas for these guys. This went on and went on and went on through the year and a half or so that I was in Jeddah. I finally got threats from the Consul General, Jay Freres, F-R-E-R-E-S, who was the driving force behind the program for these visas for unqualified applicants. And he had been outed by a German correspondent years ago, saying that he was a CIA operative. And at one point, the CIA base chief, Eric Qualkenbush, who's retired now in Findlay, Ohio, he came to me and said, well, you know, hey, we got this Iranian going over to the States. We want to talk to him in Washington. He owns a rug shop in Jeddah, and he says he's going over to deal with his clients in the States, and you know, make it look good, wink, wink. And I said, all right. And the guy showed up. He'd been to the States several times before. He had visas. He's always come back. He had a legitimate business. He had a legitimate reason for going to the United States. And I thought, well, okay, why did I need to be given a heads up on this when I wasn't given this to these other guys? Well, once I was out of the Foreign Service after having been fired for asking awkward questions and complaining to the embassy in Riyadh and to the State Department, including the Bureau of Consular Affairs and the Inspector General's Office and the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, I found out from the journalist Joe Trento, T-R-E-N-T-O, plus a couple of other good contacts, that what was really going on was a visas for terrorist program. People were being recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency with the help of Osama bin Laden, his asset, to go and fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And they were brought to the United States for training, rewards, education, whatever. And I said, now I know why they raised such hell with me and my predecessor, who also complained, but she still has a job. So I began to ask questions. I began to write letters. I began to, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request and an appeal and then a court case, and absolutely was stonewalled every step of the way. And I don't think my case is all that unique. I think it's happened to other people before, but there's nothing much you can do about it. I talked to one guy, an attorney, and he told me, well, you know, you're going to have to prove that you knew how to manage the State Department better than the State Department does.
Very interesting. Well, so just to make this explicit, this experience is particularly significant because just over a decade later, it would be that very office that would rubber stamp visas for no less than 11 of the 9/11 hijackers. And several of them were issued visas under a new program called Visa Express that was instituted just months before the events of 9/11. Is that correct?
Exactly. What had been the normal case when I was in Jeddah was that everybody other than Saudis had to appear personally for an interview. I mean, if it was a father and he wanted visas for himself and his wife and two kids, only one of the family had to show up. And in some instances, when I had questions about the Saudis, I demanded that the Saudi turn up in front of me and be personally interviewed. But in the case of the Visa Express program, they decided that they would work through travel agents and let the agents collect the paperwork and the documents and simply carry them over to the consulate or the embassy and let them be processed by the consular section. Well, I've been told by Celerino Castillo, who had been a drug enforcement officer, that this was common practice for the CIA in Central America. They would put their own people in with a pile of passports and applications for visas and send them all over to the various consular officials to deal with, and they would never be given any clear indication of what was going on. And in my case, I was dumb enough at the time that if they had told me what they were doing, then I would have been dumb enough to rubber stamp these things. But I took my job seriously, and since my name was on the visa plate, I would be held accountable for violating the law, which the penalties are fairly substantial with something like 5 years in jail and a $25,000 fine. And if it involves terrorism and things like this, it goes to 10 years in jail and a $250,000 fine.
So just to be sure, did you have any contacts remaining in the Jeddah consulate during the run-up to 9/11, or did you ever receive any information about the approval of the visas for those alleged hijackers?
I never got any information directly, but I did find out that I had kept a file on questionable visa issuances. When the Consul General Frères would demand that I give them a visa to an applicant I had just refused, or else I would be unemployed, I kept a copy of the original denial, and then I wrote in red on the form, issued per order of Consul General Frères. And I kept a file of this. I kept photocopies of it and mentioned this to one of the inspectors who had come out, who wanted to know what was going on, and he apparently knew more about what was going on than I did. And he said, we'll protect you. We want you to confirm everything I've just told you. And I, you know, very foolishly did. And then I later on, I was out of a job. And then, of course, when I asked about the file, since journalists were asking me about the records I had kept, I learned that the file had been destroyed, but nobody could tell me who did it.
Very interesting. Well, this story of yours has, of course, become quite well known because of its explosive nature and what you've revealed about intelligence agencies manipulating the visa process. And we continue to see those manipulations right through to the present day with recent reports that U.S. intelligence blocked attempts to revoke Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab's visa. And
yeah,
When these pieces are put together, it begins to paint a picture of direct government complicity in the movement of peoples who are already known to be involved in terrorist activities. So obviously this type of information extremely politically sensitive, to say the least. So what sort of harassment or intimidation were you subjected to when you first attempted to look into this unusual activity?
Well, I was told to shut up and then do my job. And I said, well, my job is to question these people. And if I'm not satisfied, because the law says they are an intending immigrant unless and until they can prove otherwise, and the burden of proof is on the visa applicant, I said that, they're not going to get the visa. And then it was do it or else. Then they went after a while to the head of the consular section, Justice Stevens, and he simply issued the visas. At one point, when I would issue a visa, I had to take the application and the passport over to the CIA base offices, and they would check on the visa applicant. And I could never quite figure this out, and was told by a couple of more experienced consular officers that this was done depending on how aggressive the CIA base chief was, and they were apparently looking for people that they could work with and control and get them to work on their behalf as agents. But, I was told by the Counselor for Consular Affairs in Riyadh, Stephanie Smith, that, this whole thing was really strange and really peculiar, and, I should complain in Washington. And I went to the Bureau of Consular Affairs and was blown off. I mean, everywhere I went, I was ignored or told I had a personality problem with the consul general. I got this from the diplomatic security people.
So once again, how did your time in Jeddah come to an end? Were you taken off that assignment, or were you actually?
I was there for 18 months. It was a regular assignment. I could have extended for another 6 months, but I didn't want the hassle. Then I was reassigned to Germany, to Stuttgart, and it turned out that the last two consuls general there worked for the CIA as well, a guy named Day Mount, D-A-Y Mount, and Doug Jones. And I got nothing but trouble from them. I was kept completely in the dark as to what was going on in the consulate for the most part. I was the political economic officer there and should have been kept in touch with what the consul general was doing, since my office and his office shared a common area with the secretary, and I was basically frozen out.
So I'm beginning to get the understanding that intelligence agencies are no strangers to the consular offices.
Oh, exactly. If you they're not only in the consular section, they're in the political section, they're in the administrative section, they're everywhere. Depending on who you talk to, one-third to one-half or more of the people who say they work for the State Department don't. They work for the intelligence services. I've been told one-third by a former station chief and by a fellow whose last assignment was in the Inspector General's office at State. But, my experience, I would say it's one-half or more. For example, in Jeddah, I had looked at the people there, and there were only three people out of some 20 Americans, including myself, that I knew for a certainty to have no ties with any of the American intelligence services, either professional or familial, being related to somebody who worked for the National Security Agency or the Central Intelligence Agency.
So how did your time with the Foreign Service come to an end?
Basically, they simply didn't renew my appointment. I had been assigned back to Washington and went to the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and then was notified that, well, we don't need you, you don't measure up to our standards, goodbye.
Very interesting. So at what point did you decide to start telling the remarkable story of the experience you had in Jeddah, and what prompted you to take that step?
Well, it started gradually. I was frozen out. I'd filed a Freedom of Information Act request and was blown off, and then I filed a lawsuit to enforce the request, and then got nothing but paperwork I already had, such as pay records and documents when I was transferred here or there. Eventually the thing was sealed as a threat to national security, which I found rather peculiar. So I had the opportunity to write an article and had it rejected a couple of times, and then it was published by Covert Action Quarterly, a magazine now out of business. And this was picked up. I was interviewed by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where one of their staffers had seen the article, And I simply went on from there. I fell in with an Association of National Security Alumni, which was essentially people who had worked for the former intelligence, had formerly worked for the intelligence services and became disillusioned and quit. And at one point, the head of the association and I were writing their news magazine that was published either on a monthly or a quarterly basis. And then I started getting things published on Op-Ed News and Jason Leopold's, I can't remember now whether it's the Public Report or the Public Record, and Michelle Chesedovsky's Global Research Organization up in Canada, along with Global Outlook, also a Canadian organization. And they very kindly published a number of my articles.
That's right. So what time frame are we talking about with your initial Freedom of Information requests?
I filed that once I was out of the Foreign Service about 1991, 1992.
So that would be about 2 or 3 years after your time in Jeddah.
Right. And interestingly enough, when the September 11th people started crashing airplanes into buildings, Joe Trento, the journalist, suggested I contact the FBI again. I tried to reach them earlier, and it was blown off. And they said, you know, call them and tell them the basis of your story. And I did. I went to headquarters, and they passed me through 3 or 4 offices, and they sent me to their Washington field office, and I talked to various people there, and it was basically, well, we'll get back to you. And I'm still waiting, and probably if they'd listen to me, I'd be in Guantanamo Bay or someplace.
So in that pre-9/11 period, was there ever any consideration on your part that there would be possible retribution for going public with this information?
Initially, I didn't think so, but then I was kind of stupid. As I've since found out, that people who blow the whistle, who complain about the status quo, and especially people who question national security, whatever that might be, they seem to have problems keeping jobs, getting jobs, or they're kind of marginalized, and this is apparently very typical. And people who start out to be whistleblowers are warned sometimes that, you know, you sure you want to do this? How much money do you have saved? If you're unemployed and can't get another job, what are you going to do? And how can you hire an attorney to defend your rights, since the law is a business as much as it is a profession?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, certainly your experience, although quite remarkable, probably is not unique. And we've discussed there are other types of interference in regular screening and approval processes that continue to be perpetrated by intelligence agencies that are attempting to manipulate and handle and otherwise facilitate known or suspected terrorists. So why do you think there are so few people who have been in a similar position to yourself who have decided to come forward to share their experience?
Well, you know, a couple of reasons. You know, one, of course, is some of them sit down and take a rational look at this and say, well, okay, if I do this, what happens to me? I mean, Russ Tice, whom I'd met through Sibel Edmonds' National Coalition of National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, I'm sorry, you know, he fought them tooth and nail, and you know, he kept getting marginalized, and they kept yanking his security clearances. And you can't work in the federal government without a security clearance for the most part. Other people that I met through there had the same problems. They would complain about whether it was the FAA or something to do with the Veterans Administration, how it treats the sick members who come for treatment at the veteran centers. They got the same treatment. And, you know, they just simply don't want to get involved. They can't find anybody who supports them, because a lot of times they support people who know about this and who can give cooperative testimony, saying, no, I want to keep my job. I want to get paid every 2 weeks. And there's also the other thing that, you know, a lot of people like this. They think that it's great. They have no moral backbone. They have no spine. They have no moral compass. And they're happy to, you know, blow things up and shoot things down. That they're happy with the current state of affairs and don't want to see any change in it. And, of course, if they did, their whole life has been a lie. Their whole professional time has been spent doing things that violated the law, you know, murder, war crimes, human rights violations, whatever. And, you know, it'd be kind of a hard thing to handle, I think, if you, once you woke up to it. Some people do, like Russ Tice. Some people do, like Peter Dixon. Some people like Dave McMichael and Ray McGovern, but others don't.
So in a sense, the people who compromise themselves in the course of their duties are the ones who are most likely to end up with the information, which would make them good whistleblowers, but then they themselves would not be likely to blow the whistle on their own activities then.
Yeah, indeed.
Interesting. Well, Mr. Springman, not only looking at your case, but the many other cases of sensitive information being put forward by insiders to shed light on what was really taking place on 9/11, and here I'm thinking of people like Sibel Edmonds and Robert Wright and Colleen Rowley and Indira Singh and Richard Grove and many, many, many others. What do you think is the importance of whistleblowing in coming to a greater understanding of events like 9/11, and what role do whistleblowers play in a government that increasingly relies on state secrets and intelligence activities to perpetrate a supposed war on terror?
Well, it's important because if you don't get the truth out, you get the fabricated truth that becomes history. Whether you're talking about back in the 19th century when the United States arranged for the Mexican government to attack a troop of cavalry in a disputed area between the Nueces and the Rio Grande Rivers and use it as a casus belli for the war with Mexico, on up through the 20th century to the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was engineered, as most people are now beginning to believe, by Franklin Roosevelt to find a reason to get into the war against Germany and rescue the British, to, you know, the Tonkin Gulf, which was a mirage or a series of lies or incompetence claiming American ships were being attacked by non-existent North Vietnamese torpedo boats to September 11th. You can't get the full story out because the status quo is far too important to the people in this situation. That if you don't get a whistleblower who questions this, if you don't have somebody who comes up with, well, why were the soldiers in the disputed territory to begin with? Why was the American Pacific Fleet parked at a forward base at the time? The home ports were on the West Coast. To, you know, what was the real story in Tonkin Gulf, and what was the real story on September 11th? How is it that all this happened and nobody knew what was going on? Nobody questioned anything. It just goes on and on and on. That, and unless you have a whistleblower who says, this was the way it was, I was there, I saw it, I have documents, hopefully, you know, a lot of times you don't have the documents. Like in my case, I didn't have my, I didn't take the copies of the visas I was ordered to issue. I left them there because at the time I trusted my government. If you don't do this, it's all going to be swept under the rug and nobody will ever know the real story.
Well, that's exactly right. And you mentioned the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and there are groups like that that are obviously attempting to encourage whistleblowers to come forward and to campaign for greater protection for whistleblowers when they do come forward. So that raises the question, to what extent does American jurisprudence protect the act of whistleblowing? And is there the need for greater protections to ensure that these heroic acts can be encouraged?
Well, there is a greater need, and two, there is some protection, but it's been severely circumscribed. The law, the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, and the citation is Title V United States Code, Section 1213, protects only federal whistleblowers, and there are some similar laws amongst the various states. I don't know how many, but they do exist. But it's pretty circumscribed. You have to disclose information that the person reasonably believes evidence of violation of the law, rule, or regulation, gross mismanagement, waste of funds, abuse of authority, and so forth. But you have to make the statement that, yes, I'm doing it on this basis, I am raising it on this basis, and it is not part of my job. Because there was one case where the Supreme Court ruled that government employees do not have protection from retaliation by their employers under the First Amendment when they speak pursuant to their official job duties. So, you know, it's basics. If everything falls into place, you might get somewhere, but by and large, you have to say it is a specific statement I'm making under the Whistleblower Protection Act. I am making it to this person and that agency that should take care of this. And not everybody does this. Not everybody is smart enough to do this. Not everybody is advised to do this. And if you're lucky, you can appeal to the Office of the Special Counsel in the federal government, which unfortunately has a reputation for protecting the government more than the whistleblower. And they've tried to strengthen the act, going a bit more than just having the Office of Special Counsel doing an investigation and advising the agency to clean up its act and to not retaliate. But it's all on the shoulders of the whistleblower, who then has to essentially do the investigation for the Office of Special Counsel. And if he's lucky, he might be able to take it to the Merit Systems Protection Board. But this doesn't apply to people in the FBI or the Central Intelligence Agency or in the State Department, for that matter, as far as I know. So they tried to strengthen this in 2007 and 2009, but it's gotten nowhere. That was one of the things that Sybil Edmonds and the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition wanted, was to strengthen the act and to extend it to the people involved in national security affairs. And it was fought tooth and nail by Tom Harris, who was a Virginia congressman on the U.S. House of Representatives Government Operations Committee. And he just simply didn't want to hear about it. And the meetings that we had with various other congressmen, they let us make a pitch, and they let the members of make a pitch, but nothing ever came of it.
Well, it's almost unthinkable that this legislation wouldn't adequately protect the people who are involved with the most sensitive secrets of the government itself.
Oh, yeah. They raised general and particular hell about the fellow who's on the staff of former congressman and senator, whose name escapes me at the moment. I should know it. But he had produced records showing that Jennifer Harberry, who had was on a hunger strike for what was done to her husband, who was murdered by CIA agents in Central America in Guatemala, he said, yeah, she's right. And they raised hell with him and tried to get him fired, and he was lambasted by the government for daring to reveal classified information that proved that Jennifer Harberry was correct in her allegations.
Well, obviously most of the listeners out there won't be in the possession of extremely sensitive information and aren't in a position to blow the whistle on fraud inside government, but is there a role for the public to play in facilitating whistleblowing?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it could be everything from, if you know the whistleblower, say, well, yeah, we support you, and we'll help you through any rough patches, to writing letters to the editor, to writing to their congressman or parliamentarian if they're up in Canada, and saying, look, we don't like this. We want something done. We don't accept the current state of affairs. The idea is to protect people who expose waste, fraud, and abuse of authority. But you know, you got to get them to do it. And a lot of people, at least here in the United States, are more concerned with American Idol or whatever football game is on that particular Sunday.
Unfortunately true, but I guess we have a little bit of time now that it's the off season for football. Well, Mr. Springman, do you have any final thoughts on the importance of whistleblowing in the current political environment, or any thoughts on people in the audience who may actually be thinking of doing the right thing and calling out some inappropriate activity in government or even in their corporation, but are lacking the courage to come forward with their story?
Well, I would say that given the current climate in the United States, whistleblowing is more important than ever. We've got this President Obama who has more soldiers involved in more wars than his predecessor did. And he's basically continuing the repressive Bush regime with, demanding privileges for state secrets for almost everything under the sun. So yeah, it's important, and we need to get the truth out there. As for the people who are considering blowing the whistle, I would say, you know, be careful, get your ducks in a row, get as much hard information that cannot be disputed as possible, get witnesses to corroborate what you're saying and what you're doing, and be prepared for a real battle, and think what will happen if I'm fired and I can't get my job back, or I'm blackballed and can't get a job anywhere else. I hate to be so negative, but really, you really should be careful in what you do and how you do it, and make sure that you claim all the protection of the Whistleblower Protection Act if you're a federal employee, or if you're in a state or a province where they might have something like this. Make sure that you examine what you have to do and how you have to present it to make sure that you've got the protections of the law.
Well, certainly it is some sobering advice, but I think some necessary advice for people who are maybe in the position to be blowing the whistle. So I definitely appreciate that. And Mr. Springman, I think the people of the world self-evidently owe a debt to you for your courageous act of coming forward and sharing your story and to help us gain a greater understanding of what was really happening on 9/11. And for that, I'd like to offer you my sincere gratitude, and on behalf of all of my listeners also to thank you for sharing your experience with all of us.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. That means a lot to me.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Springman, thank you very much for taking the time. And once again, are there any websites you'd recommend for people to find some of your articles or your work?
Sure. I would say there's Global Research Canada. There's Global Outlook Canada. There's opednews.com. There's Jason Leopold's Public Record or Public Report. I can never remember which, but they can find that. And there's also the Wayne Madsen Report that on occasion has put some information out about me.
All right, excellent. Well, Mr. Springman, thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.